accession number 27767, reel 9.
Adrian Holloway, reel 9. The third one,
who was Lieutenant Martellotta, he had been charged with blowing off the stern of the oiler. And a story, possibly apocryphal, is that he came up alongside the old French battleship Lorraine, which was lying immobilized by the mole, and said, "Valiant," and they pointed in the direction to us, and then he went off. But that's, I think, is possibly a very apocryphal story. Anyway, he had a fairly uneventful time. He was submerged, or practically submerged, and got hit on the head by a felucca oar. And so that didn't do him much good. But having set the fire charges and the charge on the oiler, he was then picked up. But the incredible corollary to all, well, I'm sorry, the damage to the two battleships was extensive. We immediately went into dry dock. And I remember a dockyard official saying to me, he was very doubtful whether the dock would be capable of lifting us, because I think we still had some ammunition in, which of course weighted us down. If a ship goes into dry dock, she gets everything out that she can. But such was the wish to get us into dry dock quickly that we may have been heavier than we thought. No, but it was just done, and there was water still lapping over the stern of the dry dock. I went down into the dry dock to see the damage, and you could have driven three lorries through the hole in our side. And I believe that to be true of Queen Elizabeth as well. So Valiant remained in dry dock until I left her in February. And I think she came out of dry dock in about March 1942 and then went down to Durban to be fully repaired.
Where were you when the charge went off?
I was asleep, as I recorded, you know, yes, in the Admiral's flat.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's right, and you were up on deck, and it was listing 10 degrees. What happened then?
Well, I've said all that.
Have you? Sorry, I'm sorry, I didn't remember that, yes. Yeah. Did you get off the ship? Do you all...
I mean, we couldn't get off the ship. We,
right.
No. I mean, we were put, you know, in the waist of the ship.
Right, and you stayed there.
But this has had an incredible end to it, in that when Italy surrendered, De La Penne and the others were brought back because they were no longer prisoners of war. By that time, Captain Morgan, our former captain, had become a rear admiral and was flag officer in charge of Taranto. He was ordered to attend a medal awarding ceremony, which was to take place in Taranto, and the medals were to be presented by Crown Prince Umberto. The royal family was still on the throne of Italy at that time. And Crown Prince Umberto said, "Now, Morgan, this is your turn." And out of the line of officers to be awarded medals stepped De La Penne. And it fell to our captain to award him the Italian Medal of Honor for having blown up his own ship. So that was an incredible ending, which could never have happened, certainly with the Japanese. It might not have happened with the Germans, but it was rather a nice touch in a way. Because De La Penne had, by that time, provided great information on helping us with getting the Germans out of Italian ports and so on. So Morgan tried to get him a British decoration, but because we were still technically at war with Italy, he couldn't do it. But that is the most extraordinary end to it.
The whole story is quite extraordinary.
Oh, incredible.
Yeah.
Incredible. Mm-hmm. And as I say, later on they made a film, Valiant, in which I think the ship that they used us was an Italian cruiser.
Always inevitably.
Yeah. Well, exactly right. So they had, with six men, as I've said, entirely altered the sea power of the balance of sea power in the Mediterranean for 6 months. It was utterly incredible. Well, later when I the damage to the ships, we didn't notice it too much. We had our own electricity and so on, and that was all going all right. But later I had to take my seamanship exam, along with the others of my term who reached that seniority, in Queen Elizabeth. And she had a submarine alongside her supplying power. Now this again was an extraordinary thing, because Cunningham had decided that although both ships were damaged, and one had gone into dry dock, that could have been just to have her bottom scraped, not necessarily damage. But Queen Elizabeth, you see, was resting on the bottom. But it wasn't altogether apparent. And what he was trying to do was to prevent reconnaissance planes verifying the fact that the attack had been successful. So every morning at 8 o'clock, a garden band would be paraded, colours would be hoisted, and everybody would go through a due ceremonial in order that somebody shouldn't see what was going on. But it was really quite funny, that, because also there was an Italian woman living in Alexandria who was married to an Englishman called Gabriella Barker. And Gabriella had a sort of concert party, rather like Ensor. And she was due to come on board Queen Elizabeth the night of the attack. And so the captain rang her up and said, I'm very sorry, but we've got an exercise on tonight and we can't have you on board. Don't talk such rubbish, she said. You're sitting on the bottom of Alexandria Harbour. It's all round Alexandria. So that you couldn't keep much secret in Alexandria. So whether... I believe that it was true that the Italians and Germans were never quite sure whether it had succeeded, not until about February. But it didn't do them much good. They never took advantage of it. The Italian fleet didn't come out and practically bombard us or anything like that. So, but certainly it was the most wonderful and courageous attack.
Yeah.
And it was rather lovely. We needn't record this, but New Year, I had a card of New Year, good New Year wishes from the Marchesa de la Pen,
really?
The widow of him. And also there was a corollary to this, in that in June of last year, the Italian destroyer Luigi Durand de la Pen, which had been called after the leader of the expedition, visited Plymouth. And three of us were invited down on board. We were piped on board, shown round the ship and given a magnificent lunch. Photographs were taken and this, that and the other. And again, that was a wonderful thing. But one of us said, I never thought to be standing on the deck of a ship named after the chap who tried to blow me up.
Extraordinary. So you did your seamanship exam on the Queen Elizabeth.
Yes. What happened after the attack was that rather naturally there was very little for us to do as regards dropping charges at the boom. But I still had to run my boat, the launch, and we had to work for our seamanship exam and to pass a navigation exam. And what I thought was rather a hauntingly stupid thing was that we, for the navigation exam, we were given a chart of Hong Kong, which by then had just fallen to the Japanese. When you take the seamanship exam, it's a viva voce exam, and you put on your best uniform and so on, and you go over to another ship and they come to you. And the captain of Queen Elizabeth, the commander, and another officer sit facing you and fire questions at you. But all this time it was most distracting because there were huge cables and water ducts sort of convoluting because they were being pumped, coming through the scuttles or portholes, and an awful lot of noise going on. And as I put in my book, I cupped my ear, hoping that they would think I couldn't hear the questions, which I actually could. But it certainly was an unnerving experience because, you know, you want to be able to think clearly, whereas all this thumping going on, so on. Anyway, that was all right, and we all passed. We all got second-class passes, so there was nobody invalid that ever got less than a second class, and one got a first, so it wasn't too bad. And I was most surprised because I hated seamanship. I thought it was the most boring subject, but I managed to answer the questions. Shall we stop there for a moment?
Yes.
Ship exams. There was very little for us to do whilst we were awaiting passage home. Once or twice I was made officer of the watch on board Valiant's quarterdeck at night, and it made me think what an extraordinary situation it was. There was I, nominally in charge of a 30,000 ton battleship, but all that I was really doing was being a sort of night watchman on the quarterdeck of a steel hull which was inside the floating dock and chasing off itinerant Egyptians. Sorry. We learnt later that all of us of our seniority were to take passage back to the United Kingdom in the cruiser Ajax of Battle of the River Plate fame. A lovely cruiser, we entrained for Portside and then joined her. There were a lot of us on board, and accommodation was certainly rather cramped, but midshipmen had been used to that the whole time we'd been in the Mediterranean, so it didn't make much difference. We were young, it didn't matter. And what is more, we were going home, which was so wonderful. We went down the east coast of Africa to Durban, where we stayed for a couple of nights, and then we went on to Simonstown. And a point that struck me there in Simonstown, I think I'm right in saying it has the biggest rise and fall of tide anywhere in the world. The Bristol Channel comes practically next. And so whilst you went ashore with the gangway more or less horizontal, when you got back to the ship, it was probably at 45 to 50 degrees. And the officer watch had to be very careful to loosen all the ropes and so on. You didn't want the gangway falling into the sea because you've been neglectful of the effect of the rise of tide. After leaving Simonstown, and we thought we were going home, we had orders to chase an German armed merchant cruiser. Now, she was supposed to be down in the Roaring Forties. And down into the Roaring Forties we went, right down towards the Antarctic. And my God, it was cold. This may have been February, which of course was summer, But even so, I was perished on watch, and a very kind petty officer gave me his tot of rum because he could see I was practically white with cold. We went round and round looking for this damn thing. I don't think we had an aircraft, so they couldn't help us. And we never found it. And eventually we pointed our nose up towards England, and we did put into Bathurst, which was the capital of Gambia at those days, owned by us, and stayed there just one night. And then, of course, it was blue uniforms and keeping a very vigilant watch lookout, because we were in submarine territory in the Bay of Biscay. And we arrived in at Greenock in April 1942, and John Cardew and I went down to Cheltenham in a very dirty, blacked-out train. And then, of course, it was the most wonderful reunion with our individual parents.
And had you managed to keep in contact while you were away? Had you been getting mail?
Ah, very good question. I never got any mail at all for 3 months after I joined Vernon, simply because it was all being sent to the cruiser Kent, which I should have joined, but which was torpedoed. I was able to send a cable to my parents as soon as I'd joined Valiant, saying, please send letters HMS Valiant. They would be addressed HMS Valiant, care of the GPO London, because, of course, the whereabouts of any ships were clearly, closely guarded secret. And so most of the, nearly all of them would come by surface mail. You could know none of this business now of ringing up your parents or anything like that. Two or three lines and a cable was all you could manage. And even then, it would be very lucky if it went through. Then, later on, there was a thing called an aerogram. And there, your parents or whoever was writing to you would write out the letter on a A4 sheet, which was specially prepared. Then this would be photographed and reduced in size and flown there, of course, where we weighed nothing more than the negative. And then this would be flown to Lagos and then across from Lagos to Alexandria. So that's how we got it. But I hated that because it hadn't been in the hands of the sender. So if you've got a girlfriend writing to you, as I had, it wasn't quite the same. then I think you did get air letters towards the end of our time there, but it was the one thing that kept morale up. The postman, our postie, was a rather aged Royal Marine corporal. And he would be the first ashore whenever you had been at sea. And I used to long for his return in the boat, and then the mail would be distributed. You see, there'd be possibly an 8-week lapse between the letter from your parents and your reading it. And so it really was not very good.
Long distance.
Absolutely.
Yes. Yeah. How long was your leave?
Ah, yes, well, I had about a month's leave and was promoted to sub-lieutenant on the 1st of May, 1942, and was able to discard the white patches on my lapels, which I'd worn as a midshipman, for one single gold stripe. I was very proud of that. You see, the thing about a midshipman is it's a very extraordinary rank. I think there are hardly any now. But you are an officer, but you're not really formally commissioned. There's my commissioning certificate up there as a sub-lieutenant. But you get saluted and you get called sir. But really, you're unless you've been at sea for some time, you're not a great deal of help to anybody. You're learning the job. Mm. But nowadays, you see, they're all so old, they enter Dartmouth at about 23 and 24 with degrees. Mm. And it isn't quite the same at all.
So after your leave...
Then we all had to do what's called subs courses, sub-lieutenant's courses. And they were in signals, gunnery, torpedoes, and navigation. And do you want all this?
Yes, please.
Yeah. First of all, I went to be accommodated at HMS Vernon, which was the torpedo school. Now, that was a brick building which had survived the bombing in Portsmouth. But we weren't there to learn torpedoes. We were there to learn signals. And we were taken by bus every day out to a lovely house called Ley Dean, which was near the village of East Mearn in Hampshire. And that had been requisitioned from Lady Peel, who'd been the owner. And there we learnt... signals. I think that each course lasted about 5 weeks, and we enjoyed it very much. The only thing was, of course, that there wasn't much to do. The cinemas had been bombed. We hadn't got any transport. Somebody did have a car. Petrol, of course, was non-existent. You could go up to London by train. That was probably, a very good thing. There certainly wasn't much to do in Portsmouth, which had been so flattened by the Luftwaffe. So the next course was gunnery at Whale Island. And Whale Island is literally an island connected to the... mainland by a short bridge, and is still in use today as the headquarters of CNC Portsmouth. And there, everybody was dashing around in black gaiters and boots, with whistles blowing and commands shouted. You didn't tarry in the gunnery course. You you were very much marched around, and if you'd done something wrong in drill or not been attentive to your instruction, your fate was to run round the island with a rifle above your head. So that taught you. One day, each morning, there were divisions in the drill shed if it was wet and the open if it was good weather. And... I remember to this day the large motto in Latin, which was on the wall of the drill shed, Sae vis pecem parabellum, if you want peace, prepare for war, which I've always thought was a very, very apt thing. And I've never forgotten it, because if you're going to be weak, somebody's going to attack you. It's like bullies. Morning divisions was a most martial thing, with everybody lined up and commands being shouted and so on. And I was horrified to find that I had been appointed to be officer in charge of the guard. Now, that had to be split-second timing and so on. You marched your fellow cadets, your fellow sub-lieutenants, round with fixed bayonets and rifles at the slope or the present, and they had to be brought to a halt absolutely on the spot in front of the commanding officer. Fortunately, I was okay. I did it all right, but I didn't have to run around the island with a rifle above my head, but it was a daunting experience. So that was Whale Island, and then... we had to do navigation, Now, the navigation school, which had formerly been in the dockyard in Portsmouth, had been bombed, I think, three times before it was decided, quite rightly, that it was ridiculous keeping it in Portsmouth, and they moved it out to a very pretty little village of Southwick, which was just above Portsdown Hill. And there, the unfortunate squire of Southwick, who lived in Southwick House, had been summarily evicted from his house and grounds, and the Navy had taken it over for officers to live in and to learn navigation. And I thought that the ultimate in really degradation was that later on the captain of the navigation school would invite the poor old squire to invite him to shoot on his own land. I ask you. But that was very pleasant, and navigation was just like going back to school. You learned how to take sights which you'd done anyway, and you learned the rudiments of navigation, of which I was never very good. But that was that. Then we went for our final course, and this would amuse you, to Rodin, the girls' school in Brighton. And there, of course, we weren't accommodated in the college itself. We did lessons there under the names of hockey captains of 1936 and this, that, and the other. And, of course, there was always the old story that, you know, if you were in a dormitory, there was a sign saying, if you want a mistress in the night, ring the bell. I don't think that was possibly apocryphal. But we were accommodated in a lovely new Bockefatz called Marine Gate, which stood between Rodin and St. Dunstan's, which was also taken over by the Admiralty. And we would go down from Marine Gate to Rodin every day. There was also a garage in Brighton, which we learned torpedoes on. And one rather nasty thing that you were supposed to do, there's a gyro which directs the torpedo when it's going. And this is a small wheel about that big. And the instructor stopped it by just doing that. And he asked us to do it, but most of us refused. We didn't want our fingers to be burnt, because, I mean, it was going at about thousands of revolutions a minute. I liked Brighton. It was very, very nice indeed. It was full of RAF who were in the Hotel Metropole. There was the RNVR training base at Hove, King Alfred, and there were ourselves at Rodin. And then one night, I had to spend the night in St. Dunstan's. I cannot quite remember why, but there were seamen there, I think, and so I was in charge of them. But I remember always that as you went up the flights of steps, each landing was marked with a number of knobs on the railing, so you know which the blind would know which landing they were on. That was very enjoyable, but of course there were tip and run raids from the Germans just across the water. And whilst we were there, Dieppe was taking place. And we, of course, had heard nothing about this. And we suddenly heard lots of planes going over. And then there were reports of landing craft coming back into New Haven and so on, covered in blood, with men terribly wounded. And then it leaked out, of course, as to what was going on. But we took no part in that at all, for which I was thankful. But that happened whilst we were there. And then, when we left Marine Gate to go home for the last time, 2 hours later, it was bombed in a tip-and-run raid, and five chaps were killed. So we were very lucky.
Yes, right, I'll stop you there.
Okay.
Adrian Holloway, end of Reel 9. Adrian Holloway, Reel 10.
After completing our sub-lieutenant's courses, We were sent on leave. Had it been peacetime, we should have gone to the Royal Naval College at Greenwich and would have been delighted to have dined every night in the magnificent painted hall. The irony of all this is that this had been taken over as a Wren officer cadet training establishment, so that we, the career naval officers, never got there, but my wife did. It was quite some time before I had an appointment after that.